Good morning and welcome to Focus 580. This is our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you listening. If you are familiar with the stories of Robin Hood and of Richard the Lionheart, you no doubt also will recognize the name of John, Richard's brother. Now, there are some questions about whether Robin Hood in fact ever lived or when he lived, if indeed he did. But certainly King John was a real king and, as you may recall, was famous for being both ruthless and cunning. However, he managed to so alienate the nobles of his time, mostly through heavy taxation, that they forced him to sign a paper limiting his own power. That paper managed to outlive him. He died just 2 years later, but the paper survived him. And indeed, as time went by, it seemed to mean more and more to the people who read it. The paper that we're talking about is the Magna Carta. It was signed in the year 1215. And this morning, in this part of Focus 580, we'll talk about not only the Magna Carta, but also what life was like in England at that time. And our guest for the program is Danny Danziger. He is the co-author of a book entitled 1215, The Year of Magna Carta. It's published by Touchstone and is a fascinating account of life at the time. And if you're interested in knowing what life would be like in Britain at this time, in the Middle Ages, and you're not already an expert, this would be a good place to start. Our guest, Danny Danziger, was brought up in England and America, and he now is an award-winning columnist for the Sunday Times. He is also the author of a bestseller that is similar to this book. This was a book entitled The Year 1000, which was about what was going on in the world at the first millennium. His co-author, by the way, on the book that we're talking about here this morning is John Gillingham. He is Emeritus Professor of History at the London School of Economics and has written many books about the Middle Ages. Mr. Danziger, hello.
Good morning.
Thanks very much for talking with us.
Well, you summed up 1215 and the situation so well. I think my work is done now.
Oh, no. Now, see, we have to put some flesh on that skeleton that I just sketched out. Maybe as a way of beginning, I would just ask you to talk a little bit about what it is that got you interested enough in this year and also in Magna Carta to want to sit down and write this book.
Well, I have to take you back to the previous book, which you mentioned, Year 1000. And the genesis of that was simply that, if you recall, in the year 2000, how we just kept hearing so much about the changing millennium. And I just got so bored with it. I thought, what was life like in the year 1000? And I did some research and found out that Ethelred the Unready was the king and the Vikings were invading. And everything I found was absolutely fascinating. And I've always had a kind of sneaking interest in history, but at school, because it was taught in such a dull way, you know, learning endless dates and age 13 having to write essays about corn laws and all sorts of things I knew nothing about, I thought I'd take a similar approach and see if it was interesting and what the context was. And, of course, bad King John. And, you know, you mentioned Richard the Lionheart, his brother, who was kind of such a glamorous figure and such a good warrior, and John was such an awful man and such an unsuccessful soldier that one was almost embarrassed that he was the king then.
And something else that an interesting point I think you make, again, making reference to the year 1000, this point that you make in the introduction to this book, the 1215 book, is how much life changed in just that 200 years between 1000 and 1215.
Yes, it sounds as if there was 215 years doesn't seem much between friends when you're talking about 800 years ago and 1000 years ago, but everything was different. In the year 1000, pretty much everyone was illiterate in throughout Europe. And by 1215, things had really started to move. First of all, there was an interest in art. Things were being printed so people could read and write. And even there were peasants, but they weren't kind of mindless, unsentient beings. These were people who could go to law, to the law courts, and pursue a case. They were people who knew that the world was round. They were people who had thoughts and feelings and dreams and hopes and ambitions. You know, they lived in houses which were houses would recognize as houses. I mean, in the year 1000, people were pretty much living in huts. Glasses, spectacles, you know, were being made for those who were short-sighted, and that was a tremendous boon for the growth of scholarship. And, of course, Oxford and Cambridge had already been established, so people were having full education, and there were sophisticated books and schools of thought. So, you know, a lot was going on. And actually, at the same time, David, transport was getting better throughout the country, and roads were more sophisticated, and people would drive their carts to markets, and the markets would provide cart parks. So, you know, you can see the kind of genesis of the supermarket at this time.
Mm. One of the things that I think is interesting that you talk about in the book is standard of living and relative standard of living, and how wealthy people lived and what it meant to be wealthy, how much money the most wealthy people had, and then what the life was like for a person that would have been a farmer or a tradesperson who was down at the other end of the spectrum, and how much money they earned and what they could buy with their money.
Well, yes, I think we said that a laborer got a penny a day, and the wealthiest people, who were the landowners and the lords, they lived in quite sophisticated castles. And it's really quite surprising, because they had indoor plumbing, and they had a sort of fairly basic but effective water flowing through. I mean, these were the Donald Trumps of their days, and there weren't very many of them. But nevertheless, you know, if you had money, you could lead a fairly comfortable lifestyle. Mm-hmm. But there was a huge gap between the rich and the poor.
Well, that's when you list some of these amounts, you talk about the fact that a common laborer might make a penny a day. Someone could live comfortably on an income of £10 a year. Someone who was quite wealthy might have an income of several hundred pounds. And then there's one point I think you talk about the fact that John had amassed a treasury of over £100,000?
Yes.
It was like half or three quarters of all the money there was in the country was
his. And you know, the funny thing was that he used to travel with his money. The sort of treasury went with him. And because there were no bills, everything was in coins. So so you can imagine actually carrying around this money in tubs, huge tubs of coins, was quite a to-do. And but there weren't banks at that time. So that's what you did. I mean, you know, if you were any kind of labor or any person was paid in cash. The cash was coins, and there were a lot of them if you were paid a lot.
Hmm. As I mentioned, that really the complaint I think that the nobles had against John, and we can talk about John's need for money and some of his difficulties, but the basic complaint it seemed that they had, there may have been other things, but the basic complaint was taxation, that he was leaning on them very heavily so he could fund his campaigns and his attempts to secure, to win back territory that had been his in France.
Well, it was ever thus. I mean, the previous king, his brother, Richard the Lionheart, had waged a very expensive war in Jerusalem, in the Holy Land. And in fact, Richard was king for 10 years. And out of that time, he spent 6 months in England. He was always away. But he was a glamorous figure who fired people's imagination. And although there were very tough taxes on people then, they didn't seem to mind. I mean, first of all, the Holy War was considered a just war and a Christian war, and one that the population was behind. Whereas when John came along, he wasn't really interested in the Holy Land. And he was, I said at the beginning, he was an unsuccessful soldier. Well, he lost so much of his family's heritage, which was France. I mean, he was practically French himself. All the kings were. They owned huge parts of France, and they spoke French to each other. I mean, French was their first language, not English. And so he was raising taxes to try and gain back the lands he had lost. And of course, that was not popular. I mean, it seemed like a waste of money. We'd had them. Why had we lost them? We'd lost them because John was a poor soldier.
Hmm. I mentioned the fact that, say, a wealthy person a very wealthy person might have had an income of something like several hundred pounds a year. What sort of taxes was John asking of his nobles?
Well, that's a very interesting question, because it wasn't like there was a kind of stratified tax code. If only there had been. It was really whatever anyone could raise. And I think it was the arbitrary nature of it that made people annoyed. I mean, for example, there were sheriffs who would kind of impose a tax on how many trees you had or how many windows you had. It's like being on a flight somewhere from New York to LA and finding out that your neighbor has paid, $100 less. It's just annoying, and it doesn't seem fair.
Well, when one thinks of the Magna Carta and what it means, what it has meant to people who came after, not only in Britain, but certainly in the United States, the people who were responsible for the American Revolution found something inspiring there. One has to wonder how it is that these nobles, those people who forced John's hand, what it was they were thinking about. Were they indeed thinking about some sort of broad and abstract kind of law that applied to everyone, that honored the idea of freedom and lack of oppression from government, or were they just thinking about the fact that they were steamed because their taxes were too high?
Well, I'm afraid it's the latter. It would be more romantic and complete story if it were justice for all. In fact, Magna Carta was, let me give you a little bit of background. It was called the Charter of Liberties. The barons had drawn up this Charter of Liberties. There were 63 clauses. And in fact, we've printed them in the book. The first ones are very self-interested. They're to do with, better inheritance rights for the nobility, better advantages on every kind of aspect of their lives. But within those 63 clauses, there are two which stand out, because for one thing, they're so different from the others. They're kind of romantic, and I'll read them to you. Clause 39, no free man shall be taken or imprisoned or outlawed or in any way ruined, nor will we go or send against him except by the lawful judgment of his peers or by the law of the land. And perhaps the most famous one of all, clause 40, to no one will we sell, to no one will we deny or delay right or justice. And these clauses somehow or other got into the national psyche as something to be held on to and to be cherished and to be a rallying point. They weren't meant as such. And in fact, when the barons talk about the lawful judgment of the peers, they meant us, them, the nobles. Peers didn't mean the juries and the kind of the way we mean it now. It just meant kind of justice only to be supplied by justice by those who have land and title. So it's kind of an accident that the Magna Carta, as it then shortly became to be known, had this nobility applied to it.
Well, and during the time that John was alive, I think that he didn't really pay very much attention to it. The Pope declared it, he voided it. Did people, even people who held the reins of power, take it particularly seriously?
Well, let me tell you what happened was that the barons had been trying to corner John for almost a year, and he wouldn't talk to them. But finally, they outmaneuvered him, and at Runnymede, which is a little place near Windsor on the Thames, they cornered him, 25 barons, and they put together this the Charter of Liberties. It was drawn up by scribes on the day, and John didn't sign it, but he affixed the royal seal to it. He had no choice. And then eventually, when he left the Runnymede, he reneged, and the country was plunged into civil war. I mean, one of the reasons what John did was he wrote to the Pope, and he said, they want me to tone down my royal authority. And the Pope, like most people at the time, believed that the royals had an incredible right to be the authorities of the land. It was just the general psyche. And so the Pope agreed that this was a terrible thing, and he also tried to ban Magna Carta.
Our guest, let me introduce again, our guest in this part of Focus 580 is Danny Danziger. He is a columnist for the Sunday Times. He is the author of a best-selling book all about what was happening in the world the first millennium, a book titled The Year 1000, and now is co-author of a new book that looks at what happened in Britain in the year 1215 with the signing of Magna Carta, and also is full of a great deal of detail about how people live their daily lives in that time. The book is published by Touchstone, and it is out now in bookstores if you would like to look at it. We do have a caller here to talk with to start out, and in Champaign County, line one.
Hi. Mm-hmm. I apologize. I haven't been able to listen all that closely on this Monday morning, but so maybe this passed. But maybe you could amplify on it, and that's the idea that the Crusades were through this period. I guess the Sixth Crusade started on 1216, roughly, but I assume in that kind of culture they'd have to raise an army for a while and et cetera, et cetera. Was some of the taxation, sort of the military spending, military Keynesianism, whatever you want to call it, of the time?
We did actually touch on that before. The Crusades had been going for some time before King John, and his brother, Richard the Lionheart, was a very successful fighter. And he raised a lot of money on his way to the Holy Land. And it was a sort of rites of passage for young nobles throughout Europe, is to go to the East and to fight against the infidel. And I'm afraid Jerusalem was ever a center of war.
But the point is making is that the common people back home have to pay for the military expeditions, et cetera, and that would be something that be seen as onerous for some. And the principalities, I guess, would be sort of in between, right?
Well, the people did pay for the war through taxes willingly when Richard was king, because he was a successful fighter, and there were victories reported and filtering back home. So the taxes were paid, but later on, people didn't want to pay anymore because if a harvest failed, you know, people just didn't want to spend money on a war. I mean, that's going to follow. And also, John was not an inspiring wartime leader, so they didn't want to put their money towards his cause.
Okay, well, I just I'm seeing a plus change in the world affairs, actually, of the time.
Isn't it sad? Yes,
yeah.
It was ever thus.
Thank you.
All right, let's go to Chicago for another caller. This is line four. Hello.
Hello. I guess I have two questions. My first question is I want to make sure that you're looking not only at England during 1215, but all the rest of the world, but through the filter, perhaps, of someone in England?
It's really mostly England. I mean, we mentioned that Genghis Khan was operating at that time.
Yes, that's my
But it's not a pan-European look, really, except, well, we go into France and Spain a bit, because the last caller was talking about plus ça change. We were at war with France. I'm afraid we were at war with Spain a lot of the time as well.
Okay. And my second question is, I'm just, from what I've read, I think part of the reason why people were so supportive of the Crusades, because it brought an enormous amount of wealth back to England, because, as you mentioned, Genghis Khan, he had already set up a wonderful trade system. So by when the Europeans came to the Middle East, they were all of a sudden a part of this world trade of luxury goods, and it must have clearly brought back, at least individually for soldiers, not only from what they looted, but just access to the trade routes and knowledge of the trade routes, it really increased wealth, and I'm sure that was part of the support that people had for Richard.
Yes, you're absolutely right. The markets became very desirable. You know, there were wonderful things in the shops and in the marketplaces, which hadn't been there before. I mean, in the year 1000, I mean, it wasn't an economy where you could buy anything. But with the things that were opening up, Well, it was opening people's eyes to whole new glamorous outposts throughout the world, and I think that the what people saw in the Middle East was what opened their eyes to this, the beginning of the consumer market.
Yes, and I have one more question, if you don't mind. Jack Weatherford just did a book on Genghis Khan, and he said that the art of the Mongols was very influential in leading to the Renaissance. And I don't know if you go into this at all, but the change in how drawings were done and portraits were done was very influenced by this. And I don't know if you found any of this when you looked at the changes of art during that time, but I'd just like any comment that you have on that.
I don't really have a comment on that. I can't myself see any influence of Mongol art in European art at this time. I mean, maybe later, but I just don't see it, I'm afraid. It was very stylistic and very English and rather beautiful. And it was just, in a way, the beginning of representational art. Mm-hmm. We can't imagine a time without photographs where portraiture suddenly becomes so much more important. You know, unless someone can do an accurate portrait of a loved one, you just have no representation of them. And it was just beginning, although it was done in such a stylized way that to be almost unrecognizable. But certainly no Mongol influence as far as I can see.
Okay. Well, thank you. I'm looking forward to reading your book.
All right.
Thank you.
Thank you for the call. Let's continue. And we'll go to back here to Urbana in line number two. Hello.
I was wondering if you could talk. I was on the British Library's website where they have a picture of the Magna or their copy of the Magna Carta.
Yes.
And they've got a translation there too.
Yes.
And I don't know, when we visited, we wanted to see it, and I remember the guy said that it's probably not what you think it was.
Well, yes.
But anyway, I wanted to ask you: they seem to imply that on the website that it's really the first written compact between, royalty and the people, sort of. But I'm wondering, is that really true? I mean, if you look, for example, to the East
I don't know if they would have claimed that, really, because it's not a compact as such. It was something that was forced on the king.
Right.
Let me just...
I was playing a little loose with what they said, but...
Well, the British Library is an extraordinary place because in the Treasures Gallery, where the Magna Carta is housed, there are the most extraordinary items. First of all, you've got the Lindisfarne Gospels from the 8th century. You have the Gutenberg Bible. You have the most incredibly illuminated manuscripts with deep golds and scarlets and extraordinary colors. You have a letter from Oscar Wilde from prison. You have the Beatles lyrics from I Want to Hold Your Hand and Help. And in a corner, with very low light to protect it, is the Magna Carta and the various manifestations it went through before it became known as Magna Carta. It was called the Charter of Liberties. And indeed, the very document that was presented to King John at Runnymede is there. In fact, the British Library owns two copies. One was burned in a fire in the 1740s and is not on display. It was saved from complete extinction by the librarian. There are two more copies. One is at Lincoln Castle, and the other is at Salisbury Cathedral. And those are the only four copies that remain. But the way that charters like that were presented was that scribes would hand-do them and then disseminate them throughout the land. But there've never been more than four found, and they are slightly different. Actually, I have to be honest and say it's not a very attractive document. It's quite dense writing in that showy Gothic script that they used at that time. But I think there's enough magic in the very title of it, Magna Carta, that brings people to it. And it's really always the most crowded area of the Treasures Gallery.
Well, I wanted to ask you about, in this translation on their website, about three of the clauses. One was 21, mm-hmm. Earls and barons shall be fined only by their equals. Well, I'm kind of curious who else would fine them. And then, then 10 and 11 stood out to me because it was, you were talking about money.
Yes.
Earlier, and this is about debts owed to Jews, and I thought that was rather strange. And could you talk about those two things?
Yes. Well, the Jews first. There was a pocket of communities where Jews had come over from France and Spain, and as I had said earlier, this is a self-interested document, and many of the nobles had taken loans from the Jews, a lot of whom were moneylenders. And one of the things the nobles were trying to do here was to say that when they died, that they should not have to repay the debts, or indeed, nor should their widow. So it's very self-serving. As indeed, you mentioned Clause 21. That earls and barons should not be tried by anyone except them. It's interesting, actually, you've picked the one clause that, in a way, people have understood to be completely different, because on that famous clause where people have taken it and championed it about no lawful judgment except by the peers or by the law of the land, they meant by the barons, not by true justice. But it's an irony that is actually quite satisfying that the baron's intention was not adhered to, and that a nobler ambition was taken from this. A nobler meaning was construed that they didn't really mean.
But are you saying that they were, quote, being fined? Who was fining them that they needed to put this clause in there in the first place?
No one was. I mean, they were untouched. I mean, what they wanted to do was, in a way, get further away from the king's taxes. So, I mean, in a way, I suppose they had hoped that they could usurp the king eventually.
I see. Well, that makes sense. Thank you very much.
All right. Thank you. We are a little bit past the midpoint here, talking with Danny Danziger. He is a columnist for the Sunday Times and is the co-author of the book 1215, The Year of Magna Carta. This family that we're talking about is a remarkable story in and of itself when you look at the family and its internal struggles. John's parents were Henry II and Eleanor of Aquitaine, and these are the people that if folks have seen the film or know the story, Lion in Winter, that's those two people, Peter O'Toole and Catherine Hepburn, Henry II and Eleanor of Aquitaine. They fought with each other. The boys fought among themselves for who would be king. If you want a story of family strife and political intrigue blended together, you need look no further than this family.
It was very sad, really, because Henry II was a very successful king. He had 8 children, of whom John was the youngest. It was a tradition, to be honest, that sons rebelled against fathers. But there was something rather sort of sad about the way all of Henry II's sons rebelled against their father, and eventually they did kill him. And it is said that his body never stopped bleeding until they buried him properly, out of some sort of shame and horror at the way he'd been killed by his sons. But it was always clear that Richard would succeed Henry II. Once Richard was king, then John launched 2 plots to kill his own brother, but they came to nothing, and Richard forgave him each time.
We have some other callers coming in. Let's go to Bloomington, Illinois. This would be line number 4. Hello.
Yeah, hello. Mm-hmm. Thank you for a wonderful program. I enjoy it every day. wondering, when you say the people forced the signing? By people, you mean, you don't mean women and you don't mean peasants. You mean the noble
nobility
of that
kind? The people who put what became known as Magna Carta in front of John were the nobles, the 25 barons.
Okay.
And in fact, John didn't sign it. He sealed it with his royal seal. I know that sounds like I'm picking up on the smallest detail, but actually it's quite important that he wouldn't sign it. And he felt that by sealing it, it wasn't quite as official as, it should have been.
Was it ever officially signed then, or?
It was never signed.
Okay.
It was sealed. But by the way, some of the people who came to Runnymede to get the king to seal this document were some of the highest people in the land, people like the Archbishop of Canterbury, Hugh of Lincoln, William of Coventry, and Benedict of Rochester. I mean, these were the Earl of Pembroke, the Earl of Salisbury, the Constable of Scotland. I mean, they really were the top people in the land.
Mm. That's fascinating. Thank you so much.
All right. Thank you. We'll continue, and we'll go next to a caller.
David, can I just say one more thing?
Yes, sir.
When John didn't sign it or seal it and reneged on it, the country was plunged into civil war, and some of the barons whose wishes had been frustrated called in the French king and offered him the crown. Now, if you know anything about the animosity between England and France, that was a pretty desperate thing to do. And the French actually came onto English soil. So that was quite inevitably a serious consequence.
Let's talk with someone else here. I'll call her in Champagne. It's line one. Hello.
Good morning.
Mm-hmm.
Wanted to let you know that I like the book Year 1000 so much. I own two copies, a hardback and a paperback.
Thank you.
And I've recommended it to many people. I teach history, American history, and I'm curious to know what is your opinion about the pedigree of the U.S. Constitution regarding the Magna Carta. My book likes to cite that as an original source for it, but do you think that's really a fair assessment?
Well, I think there are echoes of Magna Carta in the Declaration of Independence. In fact, I know there are, and if I had it in front of me, I know we've got it in the book. I probably can't put my hand on it right away. I mean, it's almost repeating words bit for bit. Actually, as we're talking, I'm trying to see if I can find the very reference to it. And here we are. To no one will we sell. To no one will we deny or delay right or justice. Well, that's very close to the words of Clause 40. In Magna Carta.
Okay.
What history do you teach?
Middle school, eighth grade.
Right, and what and any particular type of history?
Essentially, American history from before Columbus up through the Civil War, the American Civil War.
You know, there's something that's very moving about Runnymede if you go there, and many Americans do, is that when Kennedy was assassinated. There was a debate in the House of Commons about how we could acknowledge this terrible event. And the Queen gave an acre of land, it's all Crown Estate, to the American people. And there is a monument in Runnymede. If you go, Runnymede is near Windsor on the Thames. And if you go through a gate, you are then entering American soil. And there are 50 granite steps, each step representing a different state. There is a hawthorn bush, which represents the Catholic faith of Kennedy, which flowers every November, which is the month in which he was assassinated. And there on the Portland Stone is one of his most famous quotations. And it is extremely moving. And the American Bar Association also has a rotunda from which they have acknowledged their debt to Magna Carta. And many years they come over, frequently come over, to kind of pay tribute. It's very touching. I would really recommend anyone goes to see it.
That's good to now. Thank you very much.
All right. Thank you for the call. We have about 15 minutes left in this part of Focus 580. And our guest is Danny Danziger. He is a columnist for the Sunday Times. He is the author of the book that we mentioned a couple of times, and it is very interesting. It's titled The Year 1000, which was what was going on in the world at the first millennium, and also is the co-author of this new book that is about the Magna Carta and what life was like in England, mostly, at that time. The title of the book is 1215, The Year of Magna Carta, and it's published by Touchstone. And again, questions are welcome, 333-9455, toll-free, 800-222-9455. Again, I think we talked a little bit earlier about the kind of intrigue that went on within John's family. I guess part of the book that I think I find also very interesting is where you talk about the fact that I'm sure that a lot of people, when they think about marriages, alliances between houses at this time, noble houses, were all about politics. And certainly that was true. You can't deny that. That doesn't say that there weren't love matches, that people didn't somehow manage to fall in love, or that people's sexual desires led them into matches that maybe weren't completely advantageous or scuttled plans to put together houses that were. I like the discussion of this balancing, at least for people whose marriages mattered, balancing what their bodies wanted and what political expediency dictated.
Well, David, I suppose one of the things that interests me most, both in the year 1000, the year 1215, and also I'm writing a book now about Hadrian, who is the year 100, is are people, or were people, more similar to us or more dissimilar to us in the past? And sometimes, when you talk about arranged marriages and dynasties, you think, well, that really was a different time. But then, on the other hand, arranged marriages can be quite successful, and especially if you have no choice. With a bit of luck and a fair wind, you know, you can really have a love match. In the same way, you can have a love match, which turns into a nightmare, which accounts for the huge divorce rate we have now. But I think it was pretty inevitable that certainly kings and pretty much always with nobility, that they married into different dynasties, which enhanced their land holdings. But people still felt the same urges, sexual urges, love, attachment to children. In that sense, it wasn't different. In one sense that I did feel life was very different then was things like ordeal by torture, throwing people into water to see whether they sunk or not, or handing them hot irons and then binding up their hands. And, you know, if the wounds were unsuppurated, then they were innocent. I mean, that just seems to make them so different from us. Hmm.
We have a couple of other callers. Someone listening in Indiana this morning. This is line 4. Hello.
Hello. I'd like for you to, if you could give some kind of estimation, or if you actually know the number of the barons, not just the 25 that corralled them at that Runnymede. And since I don't know too much about royalty and certain levels, were the lords included, or, you know, I presume the barons are at the top, and there's subtle gradations
down. The way it works, and has worked for, well, ever since then, is when we say nobles, we mean titles, which starts with barons, and barons are lords. And then after lords, you get viscounts. After viscounts, going up the ladder, you get earls. After earls, you get marquesses. And the top of the nobility are dukes. And those are the five strata of nobility. And that lineage, I mean, we have people today who have the very same title that they had in John's time. And not many, because the nobility has kind of changed and refreshed itself. But there's still some with titles that old.
I see. And do they still have land? That goes, I mean, just because someone has a certain, say he's a duke, does that mean he will have some land somewhere?
Yeah,
or,
the dukes.
Okay,
the
so that just, that's still that way. Do you know approximately how many of the barons to the dukes were around at that time and putting pressure on John?
There are about 8 or 9 dukes only. And, I mean, for example, the Duke of Norfolk is the premier Catholic here of the land. But you know, there are many ancient lineages which still continue in this country. And indeed, you know, John is a direct descendant of Prince Charles and the current Queen Elizabeth.
Mm-hmm. Okay, well, thanks a lot.
Thanks. Well, just to carry just one little step forward with what the caller was talking about, if you go back to John's time and you think about these various levels that we were talking about and ask roughly how many people were we talking about, if we just talked about the individual, not their entire households, but the individuals who held the title, the dukes, the earls, the marquesses, the barons, and so forth, would we be talking about maybe a couple of hundred people?
Well, you definitely, it's a very interesting question. I've never counted up how many there would be. I would guess between 200 and 400, because, you know, if it, if you're an earl, then your children would be lords. So, I mean, so if you had six children, they'd all have titles, although only the oldest boy would inherit the title, but the others would be given complementary titles. So, I mean, in that way, I suppose you could be going on to 1,000.
Huh. And the population of England at the time was how much?
About 3.5 million, 4 million. It's now 60 million.
And London, was London the biggest city at the time?
Yes, there was a transition in that period between Winchester and London. Winchester had been the biggest. Indeed, it had been the capital. In fact, because of the markets, the beautiful markets and the shops that existed in London, people just began to gravitate more towards it.
And that was London the biggest city in Europe, or was Paris the biggest city?
It was between London and Paris. I'd say they were about even.
Let's talk with some other folks here. We have a caller back here in our neighborhood here, Champagne, line one.
Yes, good morning.
Mm-hmm.
I'm curious about something a little bit off the subject. Is there any possibility that they will still find any of the treasure that John lost in the wash? They found Henry VIII's Mary Rose.
Yes. I met a gentleman who I was interviewing for my column in the Sunday Times who had found King John's pendant. He was a treasure seeker. What do you call them? Treasure trove hunter with a metal detector. He was an absolutely charming man. And he'd gone out for the day with three friends. And although he was the one who found it, he shared the money. In fact, it went to many millions of pounds with all his friends who were out that day. And then he retired to Spain and went on tax exile. But before he went, he invited me up to near Newcastle, which is where he was from, and gave me a metal detector. And we spent an incredible day in a plowed field pulling up things from every era, from Roman toga holders to Charles I's coin to all sorts of things. But he showed me King John's pendant, and it was the most extraordinary, beautiful object, and changed his life completely.
Isn't that amazing?
But as to your question about whether we'll find the treasure, we haven't found it yet. It's been 800 years, but who knows?
Thank you very much.
You know, the treasure did sink. And as I was saying to David earlier, you know, because they traveled with their money and because the money was in very low denominations, there were huge tubs of coins which made everything, the carts, very heavy, and they were traveling across sand, and they hadn't gauged the tides correctly, and that's what caused everything to sink.
Well, I heard that was the story. They said it's too late, and he said, let's go.
Well, someone said let's go when
mm-hmm.
they didn't have.
Mm-hmm. Well, thank you very
All right.
much.
Well, thank you for the call. We're coming down here for the last couple of minutes. What I guess I return to saying that I'm fascinated by the book and its depiction of what life was like at this time, trying to give people a feeling for how people lived. And I think, you know, when probably a lot of people, when they think about the Middle Ages, roughly speaking, they think about Camelot and they think about how they've seen this depicted on the movie screen and would, in reaction to that, might say, well, suspect that the reality was much worse than it probably was, thinking of a time when people were lived in, there were coarse, sort of barbaric, probably didn't bathe very often, didn't smell very good, were not terribly healthy. Public hygiene wasn't at a very high level, and perhaps I think might get an idea that life was more coarse than it probably was.
Well, I think on what you are saying is absolutely correct. I mean, for one thing, I think they would have felt a lot of pain. you know, they had good teeth because there was no sugar and no kind of the terrible things that we eat nowadays. So generally, when you see the corpses, and they had very healthy jaws and teeth, but they were riddled with worms because, you know, they obviously didn't know about hygiene and they had no refrigerators. And also, most everyone had smallpox at some time, so their skin would have been pocked. And if a woman didn't have smallpox, she would have been remarked upon as a great beauty. They didn't wash, that's true, at least not regularly. And so they wore perfumes, and they tried to disguise that, because they were aware that they smelled. But you see, they couldn't swim, so water kind of held, they were scared of water. And, of course, you know, you wouldn't want to drink the water then because it was, you know, untreated. And in the town, sewage ran right into it. So, you know, water wasn't the kind of sparkling, cleanly thing that, you know, we take it for.
That was one other thing that came to mind because, as you say, the water wasn't potable. You couldn't drink it. So people drank. They drank ale, essentially, I guess, or if wine if they could. It made me think that perhaps everyone went around just a little bit soused all the time.
Well, who can blame them, really? Because, I mean, you know, with all the pain they must have been feeling. You know, we've pretty much eliminated pain from our everyday life. I mean, you know, if you have pain now, you go to a doctor, and it's rare for people to feel toothache now. I mean, most, and certainly children, don't have toothache. But then, you know, they were just constantly in pain. And 100 years later, there was to be a terrible time of Black Death and plague, where literally millions of people wiped out all over Europe. And, I mean, the letters that people wrote to each other are tragic. You know, early death was a way of life then. And we've forgotten all that. I mean, yes, we've had epidemics and AIDS, but compared to the Black Death, it was nothing.
Well, it's a fascinating book, and there was much more in it than we have talked about. So if folks are interested in reading about life in England in 1215 and about the Magna Carta, they should look for the book, which is 1215, Year of Magna Carta. It's published by Touchstone, by our guest, Danny Danziger. He is a columnist for the Sunday Times. Also, you might look at his book, The Year 1000, which I'm sure is out there and still available. Mr. Danziger, thank you very much for talking with us.
Well, thank you.